Wobbly Timey Wimey Podcast.
I'm Talia Franks, media critic, fanfic enthusiast, and a little bit foxy.
And I'm Lucia Kelly, expert at applied analysis and clever clocks, smarty pants, and lady killer.
And we're here today to talk about New Earth, the first episode of Series 2 of Doctor Who. That rhymes.
It did rhyme. It's exciting. I'm so hyped to talk about Season 2. It's going to be so much fun.
I hate Season 2, so I'm glad one of us is hype.
Just wait. All right. New Earth aired on the 15th of April, 2006. It was written by Russell T. Davies and directed by James Horse.
Reminder that time isn't a straight line. It can twist into any shape, and as such, this is a fully spoiled podcast. We might bring things in from later in the show, the comics, the books, audio dramas, or even fan theories and articles.
With that out of the way, there's someone who wants to see us in Ward 26, so let's get in the TARDIS. Okay, so we open up, Doctor's walking around the TARDIS getting everything ready, Rose is saying goodbye to her family. The disrespect to Mickey, like back and forth with Jackie, I love you, love you, love you, love you. She doesn't even have the courtesy to give Mickey a like Han Solo, like Mickey says I love you, she doesn't even have the dignity.
The most hilarious thing just happened. Lucia just got kicked off the call.
No! Fine, I'll start again. The disrespect to Mickey. Oh my God. Jackie and Rose going back and forth. I love you, love you, love you, love you. Mickey goes, love you. Rose doesn't even have the respect, the like even the like lowest bar dignity to give him like a Han Solo, I know. She just ignores him. She just moves on.
You good, fam?
I'm not.
Okay, because I was going to say, Rose, my sweet, why she kiss him? Why she kiss him? Why? Like, I'm feeling so disrespected right now. I'm feeling disrespected. Also, when is this? Why is there no snow? When did Rose get a haircut?
I have the answer to that, actually.
What?
That is a production thing. They had it scheduled because obviously, like in the timeline, it's meant to be right after the Christmas special. However, filming got interrupted and they could not film until August. So all the snow was gone. So that's why.
No, but question. I know that's why for like external reasons. I'm asking why in universe, why?
I mean, there's no answer. They decided to stay for like a while. Like literally a good 2 months, I would think, to get rid of all that snow.
Oh, green, Rose got a haircut. I mean, you know, the doctor really enjoyed that Christmas dinner and that flavor of domesticity.
Oh, like if we actually bring it into canon that like they did, like it was an that's kind of cute.
It is kind of cute.
It's kind of cute. And also explains sort of, like, Rose has come a long way since Christmas special in terms of, like, the familiarity between her and the Doctor is a lot smoother this episode. It's a lot more connected. And immediately, kind of, the dynamic has shifted so completely between, and we see this more in particular next episode in Tooth and Claw. But even in this one, the dynamic is immediately a bit more playful with 10. It's a bit more, not quite all the way to flirty, but it's a bit more jokester. They seem to be on a more even footing in a way. Like that sort of the doctor as mentor, Rose as the student dynamic is almost completely gone. Now they're traveling together as equals, which in reality they're not, which is why the dynamic is dangerous.
Definitely. There's a, Oh, speaking of parallels that you can't use because you weren't there, there's a quote from the 13th Doctor in The Haunting of Villadiodati.
That's the one with Lord Byron, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And Percy Shelley.
Yes!
I forget in which episode. They talk about how, you know, no one's in charge. It's a very flat team structure. Like, we're all friends. Like, we're a fam. Whatever. But in The Haunting of Villadiodati, Percy Shelley has a thing in his brain that basically means he has to die. Or if he doesn't die, the universe is going to crumble. So Ryan basically says, Shelley's only one life against all those others. Then Mary Shelley says, what are you saying? How can you condemn him to death like that? And the doctor says, but is he, Ryan? His thoughts, his words inspire and influence thousands for centuries. If he dies now, who knows what damage that will have on future history? Words matter. One death, one ripple, and history will change in a blink. The future will not be the world you know now. The world you came from, the world you were created in won't exist, so neither will you. It's not just his life at stake, it's yours. You want to sacrifice yourself for this? You want me to sacrifice you? You want to call it? Do it now, all of you. And then there's like silence. And then she says, yeah, because sometimes this team structure isn't flat. It's mountainous, with me at the summit in the stratosphere alone, left to choose. Save the poet, save the universe. Watch people burn now or tomorrow. Sometimes even I can't win.
And once again, 13 comes through with that clarity and communication.
But yeah, so you just made me think of that moment. And I'm like,
yeah. And
again, I love 13. I want to let her shine. And she deserves better.
Yeah. So both Jackie and Mickey leave at the same time this time, as opposed to Aliens of London and World War III, where Mickey stayed. So he's starting to recognize his worth. We love this very slow journey for him. And yeah, so they arrive on New Earth. It's very cute. They refer to their first outing on the platform as a date. And I'm like,
I hate it already. I hate it so much.
Either make it mutual polyamory or break up. I'm tired. But it's fine. They're off having their cute little, you know, rest on the grass. And then the return of the queen.
I do really love Cassandra. I really love the Cassandra that we see in this episode, where she's not like a one-dimensional campy villain. And I mean, she's still a campy villain, but she's not one-dimensional anymore. And I'm like, okay, this Cassandra I can vibe with, because she's a lot more, you know, she's a lot more, I guess it's just in her first episode, the reason I was so upset by her is because I was like, this is not the representation we deserve. And again, this is still not the representation we deserve, but I feel like in this getting to know her, getting to see her, we get to see her potential. And I really just have come to realize, like, oh yes, I do really appreciate her. And I do really, yeah. I just love her in this episode.
I can't remember if I've said it on air or not, but the parallels for me between Cassandra and Donna are super strong in terms of the journey they go on and where they start and where they end. And also the fact that both of their ends make me cry, like full on sob. I don't, how?
Yeah.
How?
I like literally my note at the end is Doctor Who is making me cry again.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, also, can I just say, I would love to have Cassandra as a companion.
So much.
for one thing, because she's actually in his age range. I'm just saying, if you're going to ship a doctor and a companion, like...
Okay, so let's talk about this kiss. I hate the kiss. I hate it. It's so stupid. That whole little, like, two-minute bit where she comes in, she's speaking in, like, rhyme, she's speaking in a weird accent, she kisses him, like, full-on snog, and then suddenly she's got all of this technical knowledge, which she never had before, and the doctor's like, new earth, new me, new rose, whatever. Like, what? It makes no sense that the doctor wouldn't clock that.
I think the doctor clocks it once she has the, as soon as she has the technical knowledge, he's like, oh, she's not Rose.
Do you? Because I don't think he does until she's remarkably unempathetic towards the flesh.
No. When he, there's this moment where he is, where he's like, when he's like looking at the machinery or whatever, they're like searching the mainframe,
and then she's like, oh, just go through this and that, and he's like, oh yeah, of course.
no, but he says, oh yeah, of course, but he doesn't say that like he didn't know it. He's testing her. He's very obviously testing her. No, seriously, watch it again. Go back and watch it again.
Okay.
It's very, very faked. It's very explicitly faked. Like, to the point where I kind of want to go and play back the clip for you just so you can see how faked it is, because it is like the way that he's like, oh yeah, right, of course. Like, it's the most faked thing I have ever seen in my life.
All right. I'll watch the clip after our recording, but for now I'm going to agree to disagree with you. Because
he does not for a second believe that there's nothing wrong with Rose.
Okay. So they enter the hospital. Also, I see you, Russell T. Davies. I see you doing a bit of clever wordplay there. It happens twice where he can't, like, you're not allowed to say, like, it's still a kids' show. We're not allowed to say certain words. So it happens twice. It happens with, I've written it down. Yeah. So Cassandra is watching them through her little spider. Also, Return of the Spider. Love to see it. So she's watching them through the little spider. And she's like talking about Rose. And she's like, oh, that little. And it cuts off. And then Rose in the next scene says, bit rich. So it sounds like, oh, that little bit rich, as in little bitch. And then later on, when Rose and Cassandra are going back and forth, and Cassandra's like, I survived through everything. I'm a miracle. And Rose is like, oh no, I saw your skin. It got exploded. What's that? And she's like, oh, well, it's from the backside of my body. And she's like, right, so you're talking out of your, and then Cassandra says, ask not. And I'm like, come on, RT. Also, I have questions about Cassandra's body. Many questions. First of all, is Cassandra's, like, her remains just being kept in a cold locker or something, if the back of her skin can be returned? And also, who, when Chip says, like, her pretty eyes were retrieved from the bin, who retrieved them? I'm like, who did that? And also, when she transfers to Rose, the skin just fully disappears. So where's the skin? Did it transfer with her? Is there, like...
I thought the skin exploded.
No, it just vanishes. It, like, glitters and psh, it's gone. Like, there's no remains of it. Does it... So where is it? Is it inside Rose? Is it, like, dispersed among the atoms? Like, I have questions. And I don't really want the answers this time. So the doctor visits Ward 26. He finds out that who's called him, or who he thinks has called him, because it never gets confirmed. And then at the end, the face of Beau basically is like, lol, I'll see you later, bye. So he was never intending to actually tell the doctor anything. So do you think it was the face of Bo that called him in, or do you think it was someone else?
I think it was the face of Bo. I don't know who else it could have been. I think it was just Jack starting some mess.
Right? Because my question is, so Novice Haim was very sweet, and she's like, I'm just company. He's very old. I'm just sort of here. And I can hear him singing sometimes. Like, he sings and I hear it. And he sings ancient songs. I'm like, but this is the year. This is, what ancient songs are you singing, Jack? What is in Jack's Spotify playlist? What is he listening to?
WAP, Montero.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some Beyonce in there.
By your name.
Ancient is a relative term when you're talking. And the lonely god is referring to the doctor, and specifically Ten, the lonely god. So we're starting with that god complex early.
Ten and his god complex. Although it was striking me just how young Ten is. Like, everyone talks about how young Matt Smith is as a doctor, but Eleven is such an old doctor, whereas Ten is such a young doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. I was noticing just how much more physical Ten is compared to Nine. Like, he's jumping about, he's running. I couldn't see Nine doing any of that. Just the way that he moves is so different.
Yeah, I was thinking again regarding Ten and his god complex. He says at one point, if you're looking for a higher authority, you won't find one. It stops with me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh. Bit.
I mean, in terms of like, who is currently at the hospital. To see his point, the only person I think who he would at this point, like, defer quote-unquote leadership to is probably the face of Bo, because he recognizes, like, the seniority. But the face of Bo is having a nap, so he's kind of out of action. But in terms of like who is quarantined in with them, who is there in the hospital? The cat nuns who have been compromised, and there's the doctor, right? I definitely think he should have a tad more diplomacy about him. But
especially when he's talking about how the Duke of Manhattan is gonna die.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love the Duke of Manhattan and his assistant are like, they bring me so much joy. That's so funny. So basically there's this whole thing where the doctor and Rose go into the hospital, then they get disinfected, which I gotta say, hit a bit different watching it in 2021. I kind of wish that was standard practice now.
Also, the whole everyone wanting to break quarantine in the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. No, like, I loved the assistant right up until the point where she's like, I'm going to break quarantine because fuck y'all. And I was like, oh, okay. Great.
Yeah, no, I was not about that.
There are 10 million people in that city. Turn it off. Yeah. So yeah, the disinfectant happens. Rose is very cute. She kind of like pushes on the wall as if to like turn off the shower. She's like, make it stop. And she gets taken down to like the under tunnels. Chip, very creepy, is like, the human child is clean. Come with me. And Rose picks up, like, I love the thought.
He calls her Rose Tyler. He says, come with me. Rose Tyler. He knows her name, and that's
the
crowbar or whatever she picks up the pipe.
Which, no, it's like, it almost looks like a Dalek eye stalk. It's like this I love the concept. I love the thought. I love that she's thinking that far ahead. But that stick is tiny. It's not going to do any damage. You could turn it around and like skewer someone with it, maybe, if you've got the arm strength, but it's not going to do any kind of blunt force.
Also, can we just talk about Cassandra and Chip's relationship and how fucking creepy it is? She calls him her pet and he says, "I worship the mistress."
And then like the whole like strokes her. The physical needs, and like I patterned him after my favorite, and all that sort of like, oh, and the whole, like the whole concept of he's like specially grown, and Cassandra refers to him multiple times as a quote unquote half life. So
yeah, and then she insults him by calling him a walking doodle.
So again, just like kind of there are parallels. This is sort of a three-way parallel. So there's parallels between New Earth and the End of the World, like fairly obviously, because we've got Cassandra back and all that stuff. And we've also got parallels, which we'll talk about much later down the track, with Gridlock, where we visit New Earth again. But there's all these themes running through this entire episode of like renewal and cycles and life and death and sort of how they're all interconnected with each other. And also how, if you think about it like a cycle, like the new can be familiar, right? So we've got new Doctor, we've got new Earth, new York, we've got...
I think it's just New Earth. I don't think it's new Earth.
I know, I was trying to be funny. But also we've got... the flesh, the new humans that the cats are creating and forcing this cycle of life. Like they're speed running it. They're just going new in this attempt to sort of control disease and control illness. And then you've also got Chip, who is another force to life form. He's been like, there's nothing natural about Chip. And so you've got all of these different, and then of course Cassandra goes through the whole cycle. She goes from this desperate need to live to accepting death. So you've got all of these interconnecting, weaving threads surrounding this idea of new life. And it's a very fitting theme for this to be the first official introduction of the new Doctor, to have him in the middle of all of that. That's very well done.
That's very beautifully put.
Thank you. Would you like to go on your tangent?
If the cat people were capable of making flesh bodies, why couldn't they just make one for Cassandra and then... she could be the new companion and we could get rid of Rose.
I mean, the Doctor would never agree to it, would it? And it would undo all of the themes, unfortunately. All the themes. The themes are so important. I mean, yeah, so...
y'all can't. But I just stuck my tongue out at Lucia and made rude gestures.
I was being polite and hiding your disgraceful behavior.
You know what I really dislike about this episode?
What do you really dislike about this episode?
Is that it played into a lot of stereotypes in making cats into bad people.
Say more.
And no, this isn't like a real issue having to do with real world racism or bigotry. This is just me having to do with the fact that I feel like this gave dog people an edge over cat people. this is also a parallel with gridlock in that they made cats homophobic, and I don't like it.
Wait, when are they homophobic in gridlock?
There's like two old women who are married, and the cat guy insists that they're sisters and says that he's an old-fashioned cat, and so he insists in calling them sisters instead of admitting that they're married. There's like a line where one of them says, "We're not sisters. We've been married for 20 years. And then he says, "Well, you know, I'm an old-fashioned cat. I'll have none of that."
Oh, yeah. I have completely misremembered that. I thought it was the other way around. And it was like a joke, like in terms of like an in-joke between the two of them, of like the cat calling it out and the old women being kind of coy. I'd completely misremembered that. Wow. These cat people. Yeah, but I was going to say, I think this is my stance on cat people versus dog people. I think people who don't like cats don't understand that the difference between dogs and cats is that cats have boundaries. That's it. Like, cats teach you how to respect boundaries. They're like, okay, I want to be touched. No, I don't want to be touched. No, I want to be fed. No, I don't want to be fed. They have rules. And if you don't respect the rules, then they don't like you and you don't like them. Dogs have no boundaries. Dogs love you whenever. Unless they're like, unless they've been hurt in the past, like a beautiful, like open dog will just love you regardless. But cats have boundaries. So people who don't like cats, be wary. That's it. That's the rule.
Okay. Where were we? Where did I put my notes?
We were with Cassandra and Rose in the basement.
That sounds kinky.
It was Rose and Cassandra in the basement with the stick.
Moving forward, because I feel like we're going all out of... We've already talked about so many things. We were not with Rose and Cassandra in the basement because we already talked about a lot of things that happened after that.
But we didn't talk about when Cassandra takes over Rose's body. And shout out to Billy Piper. Shout out to all the Cassandras. Oh my gosh, it was so good.
All the Cassandras did so well. Also, like, I just love that moment where Cassandra is hopping between 10 and Rose and then that other unnamed person, because that whole scene where all those three people were playing so many different people, just like, because like that three-way argument. And because like there's that moment where 10 is just being like, "I order you to leave her," and then but then when she has that moment and he realizes that like she's not just an obnoxious campy villain, she actually does emote and does feel, and then he's like, okay, I can work with this person. And so, and that's the moment where for me, I feel like you really do see the distinction between 10 and Rose and how they're on such completely different playing fields, because Rose can be sacrificed and replaced for a portion of the episode and the Doctor can't. Like, Rose can literally be filled in with a different companion for a portion of the episode, and we go on with the, because that's something that happens in Doctor Who in a lot of episodes where the main companion will be shuffled aside and we'll get a different companion of the week. And this literally happened. Like, we kept the actress, we got a new companion.
Yeah. The only episode I can think of where like the Doctor isn't really there is Turn Left. And that is specifically about how the absence of the Doctor is a bad thing, like capital B bad thing.
Yeah, the only other Doctor Light episodes are Blink and Love and Monsters, which I hate. So anyway, but the point I was trying to make is that we see how 10 is able to compartmentalize and be like, okay for all that I, you know, love Rose, want Rose to be around, I can recognize that the hospital needs to be saved. Things need to be done. Cassandra's not leaving. So I'm just gonna sacrifice Rose to the fact that like her body's been taken over and we'll sort that out later. Like he has his priorities and Rose's autonomy is not a priority.
I wouldn't say it's not a priority. I'd say it's like second on the list. I'd say there's like a big gap between one and two and he needs to deal with one first.
I'm saying it's not his main priority right now is my point. I'm not saying he thinks it's unimportant. I'm saying that he's able to sacrifice it for the short term in a way that if they were on level playing fields, I don't think he'd be able to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the point where you can see that the doctor fundamentally isn't human. Like he isn't the same. Like that's the point where you can say, oh, that's the point where you're like, oh, the doctor really is an alien. He really does see things in a different way from how a lot of people see things.
Yeah. I think it's time to talk about how the science of this episode doesn't fucking work. Okay, first of all, you can't, I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. You can't cure all diseases and not be curing the airborne ones. All of these walking bodies presumably also have airborne diseases. There is no such thing as sterile air. Keep that 1.5 meters away. So that falls apart. And also the ending is sweet. It's lovely, right? It's the scene where the doctor's talking to all the new cured little humans and he's like so excited and ecstatic and the music is swelling. Like, that's lovely. That's not what would have happened. First of all, why does this one ward, the one ward we see, Ward 26, have the solution to literally every disease? You only have access to the solutions in Ward 26. And putting a bunch of different chemicals together The fact that he even says, like, I know a bit about medicine myself. And then it's like, so you know that this wouldn't work, right?
I have some additional notes.
Mm-hmm.
One, why does touching other people immediately give them all the diseases, but they can walk around without any visible symptoms or having a... No, hold on. Why is it that they have all congregated in the lobby? Surely there are some people who are still trying to break into other wards who wouldn't have been able to get the magic touch that cured them. Furthermore, I must ask, how is it that, like, just touching everyone passed it on? Like, how did it pass on? Like, surely it would have been diluted by then. But you seem to be nodding, so feel free to respond.
Yeah, no, all of that. It just doesn't... I do appreciate that they introduce the disinfectant machine early on and then they use it later. That's good storytelling. But no, that wouldn't work. There's a reason you don't mix cleaning chemicals in your basin. Like... It would just fill the elevator shaft with, which by the way, small enclosed area as well. So the gases coming off that thing, Cassandra's dead. Cassandra's dead and gone.
Mm.
And Rose with her. It just, It just doesn't. It just doesn't. What are your thoughts on Novice Hayne?
She was just doing her job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. She strikes me as very naive. Like, she strikes me as someone who just never questioned anything.
Yeah.
Because, again, spoiler alert, we're going to see her again.
How does she live for that long?
I mean, we don't know how. She probably has 9 lives. We don't know how cat people work.
How long is it between New Earth and Gridlock?
Well, it can't be too long because the face of Bo is still alive and he is dying. Like, that is one of the things. Which, by the way, the, like, dark foreshadowing of when the Doctor meets with the face of Bo and Novice Hayne for the first time. And the Doctor, like, the Doctor's like, what's he dying of? And Novice Hayne says, old age, the one thing we can't cure. Once you know how they're curing everything, feels real dark. Like, that feels like some pretty dark foreshadowing in terms of how they do it. Also, I have another question. So the two head nuns head down to intensive care and they go and see this conscious patient. He's not meant to be conscious. And one of the nurses has this little offhand statement about how a different nurse who is not present has written an article about sentient life, which seems to be like directly referring to what's happening inside the hospital. So my question is, do the nuns, do they have their own little internal medical journal? Because that's adorable. Because they can't talk about it outside of, so they, do they just have their like little morning articles in the morning where they drink their tea and read about what all the other nurses have like discovered?
I know I say this all the time, but you're a little bit twisted. These nuns are murdering thousands of people on the daily, murdering, torturing. Like, yes, it's adorable if they have their own little journal, but also,
you can be adorable and a murderer. Cassandra's adorable and a murderer.
And so is Missy.
They contain multitudes. I can condemn them for murder and still delight in their internal medical journal. Oh, we've got to talk about the end scene. Oh my goodness. I immediately start crying.
Yeah. I was sobbing.
Zoe Wanamaker, man. Oh my God. Just, and I always feel weird watching it as well, because like, I wanna pass this out with you. I wanna figure it out why it affects me so much. Because at its core, what it is Cassandra telling Cassandra that she's beautiful, right? So this is self on self.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the surface, like on the surface, nothing's changed. Like on the surface, you could absolutely read it as like a narcissistic, self-gratifying moment of confirming a belief that is ultimately unhelpful to Cassandra. Like this idea of beauty, that she chases this idea of beauty is actually destructive to her. But it doesn't feel that way. It feels different. It feels like such a step forward. It feels like, to the point where I also always question how this moment changed Cassandra and if like the events that need to happen on platform one ever occurred. So what is it? What what's underlying that that makes me feel all the emotions and makes me cry?
I think for me, the reason I find it so heart-wrenching is, so for the perspective of the past Cassandra, who's been told that she's beautiful, the reason I love this moment for her is because for her, it's not self-gratifying. She doesn't know that this person who's just told her she's beautiful is herself. She thinks it's a stranger who just thinks she's beautiful. And so, and you get the impression, because she says before that that night was the last time someone told her she was beautiful. So you get the impression this was something that already happened. So you know that these events are something that already happened to her. So it wouldn't change the events on platform one. But the reason I really love it for her though, is that it makes me feel like it's a significant moment for her, because in that moment where she's able to really be with this person who is the last person who truly validated her and seemed to do it without true motive, without yearning for consequence, is something that just didn't happen. It's everyone is always wanting something from her, is always seeking to gain something from her. Like every move in her life is a power play, but this is someone who was just earnestly, like unequivocally, in like an open, heartfelt moment, just wanted to give her this gift of telling her that she was beautiful. And so for her, that was the last true moment for her. And then when she died in her own arms, that was the last time that she was able to be fully present for someone and have an emotional connection with someone. And so that's the last time that she was actually able to be there for someone else. And so that's a really meaningful moment for her. From the perspective of Chip Cassandra, it's a really meaningful moment for them because they're able to be held and be comforted by someone who, like the past Cassandra, was rocking them, telling them that they were going to be okay, brushing their brow and everything. And it's just really heart-wrenching moment. And they've been a flap of skin. When she first wakes up in Rose's body, she's astonished to feel the sensation of being in a body again. When they're in the doctor's body, is feeling the sensations of being with the two hearts, and it's the feeling of being in a body again is corn. So like the sensation of being touched when they're in the body of the other person and they have that cold realization of realizing that they've never been touched before. So touch and sensation is a really big deal for them. So that moment where they're just being cradled and being told that everything's going to be okay as they slowly pass into death is just a really gripping emotional moment. And so that's why I cry.
Yeah, I literally started tearing up again as you were talking. So yeah, I mean, I think that's spot on. I think that is, and it, because it also, yeah, that genuineness, like you see clips of Cassandra, of past Cassandra throughout this whole episode, of like her last big party. And she's constantly entertaining. She's being the belle of the ball, center of attention. But it all feels really shallow. Like it all feels so surface. And she's clearly having a great time, but it doesn't feel fulfilling. And then that last scene comes up and yeah, the genuineness with which Chip Cassandra says, because she dismisses Chip Cassandra at first. She says, oh yes, well thank you, yeah, blah blah blah. And Chip really makes the point of getting Cassandra to take a breath and say, no, you're beautiful, I mean it. And it's so much. It
really is.
Because you know, without anything else being said, like, who knows how long it's been since Cassandra's had a genuine moment of connection with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, oh, my heart.
Join Black Girls Create during the month of February for Black Wizard History Month, celebrating Black magical stories, characters, and fans. Attend weekly events, participate in the daily social media challenge, and more. To register, go to blackgirlscreate.org.
Oh. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up before we move on to favorite moments and grading?
I have to say, okay, two things. Sorry, three things. This is the first moment where we get the first instance of Ten saying, I'm so sorry. We start that.
Yep.
Another thing, I really hope that all those liquids tasted good for David's tenant's sake. He had to rip all those bags open with his teeth. Those were like fruit juice flavored or something.
Mm. I mean, balance of probability is it was water with food coloring in it, so I'm sure he was fine. But yeah, that's another difference between 9 and 10. Suddenly 10 is licking everything.
Okay, so I don't watch season 2 very much because I hate it, but watching this episode and also having watched the next episode and watching Rose and Ten's chemistry, I understand why people ship Ten Rose.
Yeah.
Tennant and Billy Piper have an unfortunate amount of chemistry. They just do. I'm just watching them smile at each other. I ship it, and I hate that I ship it.
You're President Snow watching the Hunger Games. Look at them, so cute. I want them to burn.
I think I read a little bit of the first book of the Hunger Games, but I really hated it, so.
To be honest, I struggled. I read the first book, I watched the first movie, and then I skimmed through the rest of the books because I literally couldn't. It was like my brain wouldn't let me read it. I'd start it and then I'd just skip forward.
I think I read the first two chapters and then I read the last chapter and then I was like, this book sucks. And then I watched the rest of the world go crazy over it with distaste.
Yeah, no. All I know from Hunger Games is summaries and memes.
Yeah. Summaries and memes.
Beautiful. Anything else?
No, that's all my notes.
Wonderful. What was your favorite and least favorite moment?
My least favorite moment, because I'm going to start from the bottom and go to the top,
mm-hmm.
was when Rose kissed Mickey. Because what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. My least favorite moment was also a Rose kiss. It was the Ten and Rose kiss. I hate, like, it breaks character. It breaks character. I hate it. And I also hate it because this is the proper start of what is, and I love that they gave us this term, what is referred to in the 50th special as canoodling. Stop it. Stop it. He's 900 years old. Leave that girl alone. Shut it down.
I would say my favorite moment is when Cassandra is like on the floor and just staring dead-eyed into space and says all their lives they've never been touched, and Ten offers her his hand and pulls her up and they just look at each other and then go forward to do the rest of saving the hospital and everything.
It's such a gut punch, especially because it's back to back with that scene, the really the four-way argument, right? Which is Rose, the doctor, Cassandra, and I keep stumbling over what to call these people because I don't want to call them flesh, and I don't like, yeah, but like the woman that Cassandra possesses,
the cat person that tried to attack Rose Cassandra but ended up getting murked. murked, but diseased.
Yeah. Well, she ended up murked.
And then fell down.
Dangerous height, but yeah. My favorite moment is also going to be sort of sad and bittersweet, which is the final scene. It's the best scene. It's so good and so emotional, and it's such a great payoff for the whole episode, and I love it. And it makes me cry.
I love it, and it makes me cry. That should be the motto for our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from, we'll get there.
That's just the subtitle to my entire life. That's how I experience everything.
I love it, and it makes me cry. Lucia Kelly, co-signed Talia Franks. So, The Hero and the Atom.
The Hero and the Atom. I think the hero is fairly obvious, I think. It's Cassandra, right?
Is it?
Can it be? I want it to be. She deserves it.
Okay, someone's a little excited.
All right, how can I
make your argument? Why is Cassandra the hero? What did she do?
Cassandra's the hero because I don't want to give the doctor the hero for doing bad science. He doesn't know.
At least you're honest.
Cassandra's the one who went on an intense emotional journey and came out a better person. When has the doctor ever done that?
Okay, you know what? You have a bad reason for wanting to make Cassandra the hero. I, however, have a good reason for wanting to make Cassandra the hero.
Please.
Cassandra is the hero because she knew that something was going on in the hospital.
That is true. Yeah.
She simply knew that something was going wrong in the hospital. And she, like, actively was working against the cat people. And she's the one who made the genuine connection with...
Well, yeah, she's the one who made the breakthrough that it's about touch. Like, it's they're not being actively aggressive or vindictive. It's literally just the base, like, human need to touch.
It's the base need for touch. Yeah, which I gotta say hits a lot different in a pandemic where we're not able to touch people and have human interaction. But yeah, so Cassandra's the one who really made that breakthrough, and Cassandra's the one who really did that work. And I will give it to you, Cassandra did have that emotional journey. She did have that growth. So yeah, that's not a reason to make someone the hero. Personal growth is heroic personally, but it's not like heroic in the sense that we've been talking about.
Cassandra's the hero of her own story, but I'm happy.
Cassandra's definitely the hero of her own story, especially I would say if we're talking about Cassandra being the hero of her own story, I think that Cassandra cradling herself in her own final moments and giving herself that care, especially because she doesn't even know that she's doing it for herself, but that moment of like selflessness in holding a person in their final moments and truly honoring them and giving them that space and that comfort, a complete stranger, I think is a really beautiful thing to do for a person. So I would say those are all reasons to give Cassandra the hero.
Yeah, and that's also bringing up something that we didn't touch on. It's a really lovely little meditation on how doing good, how being selfless, how being kind to others, how reaching out and choosing to connect, like, comes back to you and benefits you in ways that you won't even know at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that this idea of what you put out into the universe is what you get back.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Cassandra's the hero. Success!
You can have your little victory. I think that the Atom is clearly all of the cats in their science journal.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, sorry. I was just blindsided first by the fact that I had someone else picked for the Atom. And then I was like, right, yeah, there are a bunch of like murderous nuns that are running this institution. I was going to nominate, as much as it pains me to say it, I was going to nominate the Duke of Manhattan's assistant for trying to break quarantine. That is...
You forgot about the murderous nuns?
I completely forgot.
You forgot about the murderous cat nuns, even though they're the villain of the episode?
Yeah. I guess they're not as immediate to my current living situation. They're a bit more in the fantasy realm than a middle class white woman who thinks she knows everything trying to break quarantine to benefit herself. Shall we go on to grading?
Yes.
Grading.
Production gets a 5.
Yeah. I wasn't going to argue with you. Writing, I'd say a 4. Like, it's not all the way up there. It's not perfect.
I would give the acting a 6, but you never let me. One of these days, I'll get you to let me give the acting a 6.
And science.
1?
Oh, no, I'd say a 2.
A 2? Okay, we're being generous.
Yeah, because the thing is, aside from the ending, I really liked the psychograft. That made sense to me. I really liked, even though they got it through unethical means, I did like the... So, to bring up the... You said before about, like, so why are the new flesh... Why are they walking around if everything's... Everything's fine, and when they touch people, they just die instantly. The doctor has a moment where Rose asks the same question, basically. It's like, well, why are they still around? Oh, Cassandra does. And the doctor says they're plague carriers. They're the last to go. So basically, they are dying. They will die soon, but they're sort of the quote-unquote strongest. So they're going to last a little bit more. But rewatchability. I'm going to go with 5. I would rewatch this anytime. It's a good episode.
It is, in fact, one of the only tolerable episodes in season 2. Yeah. Let's see. What else do we have in store for season 2? Tooth and Claw sucks. Seal Reunion is okay. Girl in the Fireplace, it's tolerable. Rise of the Cybermen, no. Age of Steel, no. Idiot's Lantern, blah. Impossible Planet, blah. Satin Plant, Satan Pit, blah. Love and Monsters, ugh. Fear Her sucks. Army of Ghosts sucks. Doomsday sucks.
I can't believe you. Those are like...
Yeah, so I guess this one, School and... Impossible Planet and Satan Pit are okay.
Thank you. This season, I'm going to make it my mission. I'm going to turn your mind around on season 2. Season 2 is good. Season 2 has a lot of good episodes in it.
No, actually, I'm thinking about it. I actually really like Impossible Planet and Satan Pit.
Exactly.
So there are 4 tolerable episodes in this season. Okay, Girl in the Fireplace sucks. Madame de Pompadour is proto Amy Pond, and you will not be able to convince me otherwise. She's like the worst of Amy Pond and River Song mushed together and put in France.
I do have my own issues with The Girl in the Fireplace, which are mainly down to the characterization of Madame de Pompadour, but I remember it being a fun, good episode. So, although, and I'll bring it up when we do the recording for it, but this was the episode that scarred me. Like, I had a genuine, absolute, real phobia of masks for a good 6 years because of that episode. Because I watched it way too young. So, I've done the math.
Did you do it right this time?
I did.
I'll let that go by season 3, maybe.
Listen, I love math. Math doesn't love me. But it got a B. It got 84%. Yay! Which, yeah. It's the science, man. Just, I'm literally just asking for common sense. Just common sense science. It's a low bar. And yet. Anyway, I'm so excited. Let's move on to Tooth and Claw. Thank you for listening to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this adventure with us through space and time.
You can find us elsewhere on the internet, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram at WibblyPod. Follow us for more Wibbly Wobbly content.
You can find out more information about us and our content on wibblywobblytimeywimey.net and full transcripts for episodes at wibblywobblytimeywimey.net/transcripts.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at wibblywobblytimeywimeypod@gmail.com.
Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and other platforms, as it helps other people find us and our content.
That's all for now. Catch you in the time vortex.